Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. This week, we spent some time out with Governor Newsom talking about the biggest issue in California, homelessness. And then we talk about Governor Newsom with Ron Brownstein of The Atlantic, who's interviewed him and written about him there. We talk about President Biden and some of his successes and where he goes from here in the midterms. And we talk about Ron's book called Rock Me on the Water, which looks at 1974 in Los Angeles and how that really has shaped our culture ever since, from TVs to movies to music to politics. Really fascinating book. But let's start with the governor of California back in Southern California this week talking homelessness. And we were out with him. Take a listen. Governor Gavin Newsom visits a first-of-its-kind pilot program to deliver services for the homeless. It's just steps from an encampment in downtown L.A.
We've got to bring government onto the streets. We've got to meet people where they are.
This statewide pop-up delivers health screenings, counseling, and COVID vaccines to those living on the streets, including to Kim Jameson and his dog.
Resources is what everybody needs.
The governor says many of the people working here recently set up a similar site at the McKinney Fire in Northern California.
This is sponsored by the Office of Emergency Service. We're taking that model of benefits and we're bringing that now to the emergency that is homelessness in the state of California.
They say one of the most important spots here is what you're looking at right there from the DMV. Many people experiencing homelessness don't have IDs, and that can make other aspects of life very complicated.
Any of our staff can replicate this.
California's Transportation Secretary, Tokes Omashekin, is overseeing the ID program.
For access to anything, essentially, in state government, you're going to need an ID.
With so many of California's homeless addicted to drugs, they hand out overdose bags.
What goes through your mind, the fact that you have to hand out an overdose bag to people on the streets of Southern California?
I mean, this is a symptom of our failure, not our success.
Those kits include tests for fentanyl.
We're here to save lives. We believe that every life is precious.
The governor says long-term, the idea is to get people away from sites like this and into permanent supportive housing sites like he also visited this week in Los Angeles. The governor here setting up a new apartment for someone who once experienced homelessness through his Project Home Key initiative. He gathers new items, helps make the bed, and writes a note, quote, welcome home, emphasis home. Congrats on the next phase of your life. The best is yet to come.
Pride in this context, I mean, it's a big deal.
The governor announcing nearly $700 million in new funds for Project Home Key, which will build 2,500 units like this one.
Create a pathway for solving the crisis of our time, homelessness.
The governor admits more than 150,000 Californians currently living on the street is unacceptable.
Decades of neglect led us to the conditions that we're experiencing today. Radical new strategies and approaches, and you should expect radically different results in the next few years.
Project Home Key started at the beginning of the pandemic, and at first the focus was on converting old hotels and motels. Now it's expanded to include places like this. Pico Square was supposed to be market-rate apartments. Now they'll be offering supportive services here, including those that are experiencing mental illness and drug addiction. The state pledging $83 million for operations, including social services. What kind of supportive services will they get at a place like this? And what do you say to people that are concerned about people who are struggling with those issues moving into their neighborhoods?
People don't want them in their backyard because they're nervous and scared about that. And one of the great things about the Room Key, Home Key model is the technical assistance that comes with it from the state.
So far, the state has pledged $3.75 billion overall for the Home Key program. He talked on camera for the first time about his decision to veto a bill that would have allowed safe drug injection sites for heroin in Los Angeles, Oakland, and San Francisco.
This is a commitment through this legislation for unlimited number of these sites with no plans that have been attached.
Do you like the concept?
Well, I've always been open. In fact, in the veto, made that point. But it's going to be on different terms than open-ended terms.
Vote yes on 27.
And he weighed in on Prop 27, an initiative to legalize sports betting that is blanketing the airwaves of California with ads claiming that the measure will help fight homelessness.
Perhaps that initiative will provide a few dollars. I'm not supporting or opposing it. I haven't even given a lot of thought, but it is not a homeless initiative.
Doesn't sound like quite the endorsement for Prop 27. All right, let's bring into the conversation now Ron Brownstein. You see him on CNN all the time. You've read him in The Atlantic. He wrote a big article about Governor Newsom for The Atlantic. He's got a new book out called Rock Me on the Water, which we'll talk about more a little later. Let's begin by talking about Governor Newsom. Joining us now to discuss more is Ron Brownstein. You see him all the time on CNN. He is the author of Rock Me on the Water, which is available now in paperback. We'll go in depth on that book in a little bit. It's great. He's also the author of this piece for The Atlantic. It's entitled The Democrats' New Spokesperson in the Culture War. You see him right there, Governor Gavin Newsom. Ron, welcome to the issue.
Thanks for having me.
Where do you see Governor Newsom's place right now in the in the Democratic Party, and what do you make of his moves?
I think he's filling a vacuum in the Democratic Party, you know, kind of the classic example of political entrepreneurship. There is enormous anxiety across the Democratic coalition, all the key groups, all the key constituencies, about the rollback of rights that is underway in many of the red states, Texas and Florida at the forefront of the list, abortion rights, voting rights, LGBTQ rights, book bans, classroom censorship. For a variety of reasons, Joe Biden isn't really comfortable being the point of the spear and pushing back on that. He has never really been much of a culture warrior to begin with, and his overall message is focused more on bringing the country together. And I think there was a feeling in the Democratic Party as the months went on and DeSantis in Florida and Abbott in Texas were pursuing and passing this very aggressive agenda. In fact, you know, almost two dozen red states are pursuing versions of this agenda, that there was kind of no effective response. And I think Newsom, as a governor of California, which carries, you know, certain vulnerabilities and liabilities, but nonetheless gives him a very logical platform from which to be the voice saying, look, these people, you know, these governors are going in the wrong direction. And I think he found a niche. And the evidence seems to be that he's filling the niche in a way that is raising his profile across the Democratic Party.
Well, and it seems like his favorite person to spar with is Ron DeSantis of Florida. Yeah. And just this week, he doubled down on that. Mm-hmm. He's making a donation to Charlie Crist, the former Republican governor of Florida, who's now running as a Democrat, got the nomination this week and got a $100,000 donation from Gavin Newsom. Here's why the governor says he did that. Take a listen.
I like Charlie Crist, and I don't like bullies. You want to ask what my why is in life? I don't like bullies. I don't like people that demean people. I don't like people that talk down to people. I didn't like what DeSantis said about Fauci the other day. He may disagree with him, but to call someone pejorative terms because they're short, I mean, who the hell raised these guys? What kind of people are they? I mean, I know all of us had to, you know, sit there and suck it up and take Trump's demonization, but not everybody has to act like him. I mean, literally, I remember growing up and folks would have their mouths washed out with soap if they talked like this. I got four kids. I don't want these guys being models. You're attacking LGBT community, you're attacking women. I mean, this guy's so extreme. You rape and incest. Ron DeSantis talks about freedom and a young girl's raped by her father. Doesn't have the right to her own body to make her own decisions. Spare me freedom. There's no freedom. There's no choice. So, yeah, I'm standing up as a human being. Got to use those dollars, and I hope others of you send money to send a message that if that's the future of the damn Republican Party, this country's in real trouble.
My grandmother once washed my mouth out with soap,
really?
And it's not fun.
Yeah.
Not a good thing. What do you make of that? Pretty tough language there.
Yeah, look, if you want to be the Democrat to step into the ring with Ron DeSantis, there are going to be a lot of Democrats who say, you know, let's go. I mean, DeSantis is both a potential future Republican nominee, but even if he defers to Trump in 2024, he is the symbol of what's happening. You know, we've talked about this before. We are watching basically a 60-year trend in American life move into reverse. I mean, starting in the 60s, what legal scholars call the rights revolution, you know, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the contraception decision, the abortion decision, the ADA, Title IX, more rights were nationalized, and the ability of states to constrain those rights was reduced. And beginning over the last several years, we are seeing a concerted effort in the red states with support from the Republican majority on the Supreme Court to move back to a pre-1960s world where your basic rights depend much more on your zip code, on where you live, much more divergence in what voting rights look like or abortion rights or LGBTQ rights. And so Newsom, I think, by taking on that space, which, by the way, the overall Democratic messaging in the midterm campaign is moving toward. You know, I mean, the White House instinct is to fight on kitchen table issues. That's where Biden is comfortable. We are for you. Republicans are for the special interests. That is essentially the messaging that the White House wants to center on for November. That really isn't where the party is and where the energy in the party is. And much closer to fighting about this idea that Republican states are coming for your freedoms, plural, interesting, freedoms versus freedom, which is more of a Republican word. And I think Newsom is pretty effectively establishing himself as a leader of Democrats who want to press that fight.
And then he had this big decision this week about the safe injection site.
Yeah.
And he ended up vetoing this. This is something a lot of progressives wanted.
Right.
A lot of people speculated this might have something to do with a potential political run down the line and not wanting to have a bunch of negative ads saying that you allowed heroin users in San Francisco. Mm. How do you read this?
I read it both from policy and policy. I think your political instinct is right there. I mean, you know, he is, first of all, the state is out on a limb on a lot of progressive issues, and he, as we're talking about, is out on a limb on a lot of progressive issues, and there are only so many fights that it makes sense to take on at any given point. But, you know, this is also consistent with his proposal for the care courts, right? I mean, requiring people to get treatment for drug abuse and mental health, in some cases, people who are out on the street. We saw in the strong showing by Caruso, which may not get him over the top in the end, and we saw in the effort to recall Gascon and the successful effort to recall Boudin, there is a desire for order in the electorate, even in left-leaning blue cities. And I think Newsom is trying to respond to that or bend to that. It didn't surprise me that he decided this was a bridge too far.
Meanwhile, it doesn't seem to be hurting him in terms of his poll numbers in this state. We look at this is the new Berkeley IGS poll showing him in his race for governor. You almost forgot that he's running for governor this year. He's up against State Senator Brian Dahle, who most people in the state don't even know who he is. Mm-hmm. Newsom at 52, Dahle at 25, which is why a lot of people are now already thinking about the presidential run. He's told us a million times he's not running. Is he a legitimate presidential candidate? Would he have a real shot if Biden doesn't run?
He is a legitimate presidential candidate if Biden doesn't run. I believe so. But Biden not running, if Trump runs, seems to me highly unlikely.
Yeah. Do you want to get that?
Yeah. Sorry. I thought I put it on airplane mode. Sorry about that.
All good. It's okay. It happens. I'll ask that question one more time.
Let's ask that.
So we'll do a pickup when you're ready.
Yeah.
Is Gavin Newsom a legitimate presidential candidate?
If Biden doesn't run, I think he is a legitimate presidential candidate with the positioning and the lane that he has filled and the platform that he has. Obviously, there are other legitimate candidates. The predicate, though, is Biden not running. I mean, I don't think Gavin Newsom is going to challenge Biden. I'm not even sure he would challenge Kamala Harris, although I don't think that's impossible. But, you know, the issue for Democrats is whatever is the sentiment in the party. Joe Biden believes that his final mission in American politics is to prevent Donald Trump from ever being president again. I think that is very clear to people in the White House. And as long as it seems likely that Donald Trump is going to run, it's going to be very hard to convince Joe Biden not to run.
Yeah.
You know, and especially if, against all odds, this midterms ends up as being less of a red wave than everyone was expecting 4 to 6 months ago.
Well, we got to stop you there because we got to get a commercial break in. But when we come back, let's talk more about Joe Biden, about the midterms, about where things are at. It seems like things may be changing a little bit. More with Ron Brownstein right after this.
Well, I believe my plan is responsible and fair. It focuses the benefit on middle class and working families. It helps both current and future borrowers, and will fix a badly broken system.
President Biden talking about forgiving student loans this week. The announcement forgives $10,000 of debt for those making under $125,000, $20,000 for Pell Grants. We're back with Ron Brownstein of The Atlantic. He's had a lot of legislative wins recently. How do you assess Joe Biden's performance right now?
He's gotten more done than seemed possible, certainly six, 8 months ago, if not quite as much as they were hoping at the outset. I mean, Joe Manchin did, and Kyrsten Sinema did, have a significant impact in narrowing what they were able to do and basically pushing out almost all of the expansion of the safety net, the social safety net. But in terms of investment in the future productivity of the economy, you're talking about the infrastructure bill and then all of the climate and clean energy investments in the slimmed down reconciliation package. They put a substantial amount of money on the table, a stake in the ground. You know, I'm reminded Obama in 2012 was able to go around the Midwest with the auto bailout and say, we saved your jobs, or we preserved your communities. There are going to be a lot of EV plants opened in the industrial heartland, battery plants, you know, subcontractors, people involved all up and down the solar kind of supply chain. There's going to be a lot of that happening between now and 2024 and certainly beyond. I think that's going to be a very powerful calling card for them. They did not achieve a lot of what they wanted on the social side, not only the social safety net, as I said, but pretty much all of the rights issues, where the House, without much notice, has passed legislation to undo what the red states are doing on voting, on abortion, on LGBTQ rights. All of them have been blocked by the Senate filibuster. But overall, you'd have to say, in a 50-50 Senate, a five-seat majority in the House, it's pretty remarkable how much they end up getting across the finish line.
So where did that leave things for the midterms? All year long, there's been this thought of a red wave or a red tsunami, this idea that Republicans are almost certainly going to win the House, have a good chance of winning the Senate. Recently, even Mitch McConnell admitting that, you know, their chances of getting the Senate aren't that great because of candidate quality,
which is some of the people endorsed by Trump candidates that Mitch McConnell
didn't really like.
Mm-hmm. But he chose not to fight.
How do you see the state of play for that? Has there been a real change?
Clearly, there's been a change. I mean, you know, we are having kind of a split decision election. In the House, you know, there are only four times since the Civil War where the party out of power hasn't gained the five seats that Republicans would need to win the House. House races have grown to be more parliamentary. They'll become somewhat more anonymous. They're more about the direction of the country, the president's approval rating, right track, wrong track. All of that makes it hard for Democrats to hold the House, even if the size of the gains aren't as, for Republicans, are not nearly as big as they were. Talked about earlier this year, largely because white-collar suburbs that moved away from the Republican Party, 16, especially 18 and 20, are staying away, as we see in these special elections. And that narrows the playing field. I mean, if Democrats who won these basically white-collar suburbs in 18 and 20 are safer because issues like abortions, guns, and democracy slash Trump have become more viable, the Republican playing field is smaller. Then when you get to the statewide elections, you have that factor, which is the Democrats are still dominating in these white-collar suburbs. But the larger factor is that you have Republican candidates who are essentially hand-selected by Trump in races like the Georgia and Arizona, Pennsylvania Senate races, the governor races in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Arizona. I think I got all those right. All of whom are struggling. And, you know, it's something interesting. A rational party, if that plays out this way, and Trump endorsed candidates ultimately fall short in all five of the states that moved from Trump in 16 to Biden in 20, which are Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, where they could lose the governor race in all three, Arizona, where they could lose both the governor and senator, and Georgia, where they could lose the senator. If that happens, a rational party would look at that and say, you know, maybe this is not the formula that is going to win back the states we need to get to 270. But what are the odds that Ron DeSantis or Mitch McConnell even would get up the day after the election and say, maybe this isn't the right path for us anymore.
Meaning Trump, who is hovering and has all this influence and seems to be growing influence with every criminal investigation into him.
Consolidating the base, yeah. Even as the center recoils. That's what's happening.
All right. Well, up next, we want to go a little bit back in time to talk about your book, which is called Rock Me on the Water.
He had the answer to inflation. The country's got to produce more goods. Then we got to have a little more unemployment. So when there's more goods to buy and less people who can afford to buy the goods, then the prices will come down.
That was Archie Bunker on All in the Family in 1974 talking about the issue of inflation. I'm glad that inflation has gone away since then. We don't worry about that anymore. Our guest, Ron Brown, sitting right here, has written a whole book about that landmark year, 1974. Here it is. There it is on the screen. Rock Me on the Water, 1974, the year Los Angeles transformed movies, music, television, and politics. Again, it's out in paperback now. There's a lot to get into here, but let's try to separate it a little bit. Yeah. Let's start with my favorite thing, which is TV. Of course, we're in the TV business here. So back in 1974, you had All in the Family, which was talking about families in new ways on TV. Also politics, of course. Mary Tyler Moore talked about women in the workplace in new ways. MASH talked about the Vietnam War. These shows were really talking about real issues that people cared about as compared to years before. It was all sort of fantasy land and escapism, right?
They lived in the same world as the viewers. I mean, Archie Bunker lived in the same world as the people watching the show. You know, and the basic story of Rock Me on the Water is that the pop culture produced in L.A. in the early 1970s, television, movies, and music, was the crucible in which the critique of American life that emerged out of all the social movements in the 1960s was kind of cemented into our consciousness, never to go away. Greater suspicion of business and government, you know, greater suspicion of authority, changing roles for women, changing relations between men and women, more assertiveness. Among groups that had been previously marginalized. All of these ideas, it's hard to remember the world that existed before what we're operating in. But in the 1960s, television and Hollywood completely ignored all the changes that were happening around them. I mean, television didn't get any closer to Vietnam than Gomer Pyle and McHale's Navy. So then all of a sudden you have MASH, which is essentially Vietnam with the thinnest, the fig leaves, you know, commenting on the war as it's happening. You have Archie and Mike Stivic, Rob Reiner and Carol O'Connor, condensing the generation gap into a single living room. And you have Mary Tyler Moore embodying the changing role of women. In all of these ways, TV became part of the world around it in a way that it had not when it was Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and Green Acres.
Yeah, and then when it comes to movies, we had movies like Chinatown and the growing star power of Jack Nicholson, who was quite a player in the L.A. scene, too. Yes. It's great to hear about his off-the-screen stuff, too. And then you have Godfather 2 and the growing star power of Al Pacino. And, of course, this also new generation of directors like Francis Ford Coppola, and sort of the way that they view the world and how that started to change Hollywood and still is all these years later.
Right. I mean, as I said, the movies like television engaged with the world around them to an incredible extent, really starting with Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate in 67, and then the kind of the tipping point, Easy Rider in 69. But the incredible outpouring of movies in the early 1970s, Carnal Knowledge, Five Easy Pieces, Chinatown, Godfather 1, Godfather 2, The Candidate, a little later, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest Network. I mean, all of these movies, like the TV shows, believed that they could comment on the society around them. And one reason why the early 1970s is considered, along with the late 30s and early 40s, one of the two great periods in Hollywood history is that, as you noted, there were two distinct generations of directors producing much of their greatest work. You had an older generation like Robert Altman and Roman Polanski and Mike Nichols who had been waiting for these doors to open, you know, who had these, who were kind of, you know, grinding away in the more formulaic stuff that both TV and movies did in the 1960s. And then you had the first movies by the directors born in the 40s, the movie brats, Spielberg, Scorsese, George Lucas, Brian De Palma. It's an incredible assemblage of talent. And I say they were almost like shooting volleys across the canyons back and forth at each other. And I talk about in there Nashville from Altman and Jaws from Spielberg, shot at the same time, released at the same time, kind of the pivot from the personal social critiques of the early 70s to the great mass market entertainment that followed with Star Wars and everything else.
And we still are Star Wars so such an important thing today. Let's talk about the music, because it was kind of crazy that almost all these guys were living like one or two blocks away from each other in Laurel Canyon, right? We have the Eagles were huge at this point, ended up releasing soon after one of the biggest selling albums of all time. We also had Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young going on a big tour in 1974. Joni Mitchell was at sort of the height of her power, too, and also involved with a lot of these guys as well. Jackson Brown was very successful at this point. Your book is titled based off of one of his songs, of course. And then you especially get into Linda Ronstadt, who I think may be the most interesting character in your book. Let's listen to some of Linda singing. I mean, she was so good, but she had a real struggle at this point.
She was, first of all, she was not only an incredible talent, she was maybe, along with Angelica Houston, the most perceptive observers of the scene. I mean, she really had a great understanding of other people, and she's just a really interesting and smart and perceptive person. Yeah, I mean, Linda Ronstadt is interesting. I mean, she came out here in the 60s. She had an early hit with her band, the Stone Ponies. But then really, for years, kind of was grinding gears. She was, like many in L.A. music in that period, she was trying to find a new synthesis between country and rock and rhythm and blues. And the studio, the record companies really didn't know what to do with it. It wasn't until she connected with Peter Asher in 1974, which is her breakthrough year. It was also the breakthrough year for the Eagles with their third album, On the Border, the biggest hit for Jackson Brown, his album that year, and Joni Mitchell, her biggest hit ever. It really was the apex of it was the moment when the Southern California sound really dominated the music conversation. And, you know, and as that moved away, it was really social change. But the Southern California sound was, the Southern California dream was really a 60s dream of kind of personal liberation, however you define that. And as the decade went on, and the, you know, kind of the 70s gas lines and inflation and everything else, pop culture moved in a different direction, a harder direction. The punk movement emerged in New York, and that's what really supplanted the SoCal sound.
So when we talk about Linda Ronstadt, we also should mention her boyfriend at the time. Some people may have heard of him. He became the governor of California in 1974, the youngest governor in California history. Of course, we now know him as the oldest governor in California history, Jerry Brown, just 36 years old then.
And won his primary 2 weeks before the release of Chinatown, both against the backdrop of Watergate and a sense of pervasive corruption that he very, very successfully ran against as one of the first candidates anywhere in the country who brought that same critique of American life that emerged in the 60s that I talked about in pop culture. He brought it into the political arena. Him and Gary Hart in 74 really are the first ones.
And, of course, still impacting California politics to this day as well. We are back with Ron Brownstein. We play a game on this show called Personal Issues. This is where we get to know you. We put 30 seconds up on the clock. You talk about a lot of other people's favorites in this book, Rock Me on the Water. Now we get to know your favorites, okay? So here we go. You ready to go?
Ready.
Let's do it. Favorite TV show?
All in the Family, I think.
What is your favorite book?
Master of the Senate, Can't Beat That, and Cavalier and Clay on the fiction side.
What about movie? Favorite movie?
Godfather, Chinatown, It's a Wonderful Life.
Who's your favorite sports team?
Red Sox.
What's your favorite musical artist or band?
Springsteen.
Oh, good choice there. And who is your role model?
You know, everyone would love to be Robert Caro, but that's beyond reach of us mere mortals. I would say actually Peter Gammons. The way he covered sports always inspired me to how I wanted to cover politics. But I think the person I've followed whose tracks most clearly is Tom Etzel.
And who is that?
Tom Etzel is a great journalist and author from the Washington Post in the 80s and 90s, and now writes a column in the New York Times. He pioneered thinking about politics through the lens of demographics and social change, which is what I've tried to do over these last 30, almost 40 years now.
Yeah, and for people that may not know, Robert Caro written extensively about Lyndon
Johnson,
these amazing books.
Gammons
for years was on ESPN talking
great
about baseball and all the rest of it.
Great writer for the Boston Globe,
Our thanks to Ron Brownstein, our thanks to Governor Newsom, our thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more of The Issue Is. In the meantime, hope you like us, rate us, comment, send me messages on social media. We'll see you next time.